From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Was President Clinton a CIA informant in his youth?
You remember that in 1992, George Bush and the Republicans tried to accuse Bill Clinton of being disloyal, of having, there was the implication that he might have even worked for the KGB or for the other side. These sources told me in utter seriousness that it was quite the opposite. They were familiar with something called Operation Chaos, which was an effort by Lyndon Johnson ordering the CIA to find out if there was any North Vietnamese or Soviet influence in the anti-war movement, which was then very controversial in the United States. The CIA did go out and recruit informers among American students, both abroad and in the United States, to inform on their fellow anti-war activists. Bill Clinton was one of those.
A conversation with Roger Morris, author of Partners in Power, The Clintons and Their America. And the Libertarian Party is holding its national convention to nominate a presidential candidate on the ballot in all 50 states. That and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We hope all of you are having a restful and radical July 4th weekend. The Libertarian Party is currently holding its national convention in Washington, D.C. Over 700 delegates from all 50 states have come to the nation's capital to nominate the Libertarian Party candidate for president and debate the party's platform for 1996. The opening speaker at the convention was Jacob Hornberger, the president of the Future of Freedom Foundation, a free market libertarian think tank based in Virginia. In his fiercely anti-government speech, Hornberger points to the failures of almost every government program, including public education.
Public schooling, welfare for the middle class, busted. And of course, look, the best evidence of failure on public schooling, of course, is how government officials themselves refuse to send their own children to these government institutions. Like Bill Clinton and his daughter Chelsea, and like an ever-growing number of public school teachers who are taking their own children out of the public school system. Busted. And look at the beloved wars that have been waged against the American people by these Remocrats and Republicans. That's what the Wall Street Journal calls them. Because there ain't a dime's worth of difference between those two parties, and we all know it. They share the same commitment to these failed policies, the same commitment to these failed wars that they have waged against their own people. The beloved war on poverty. 30 long years, and what do they tell us? That there's more hunger, homelessness, and poverty in America than ever before. That's supposed to be progress? There's the beloved war on drugs. Oh, wait, that one's been a big success after 80 years? Well, it's been a success for those who have benefited from it. Drug lords, politicians, and bureaucrats. Right now, there are DEA officers and local sheriffs and deputies out on the highways and airports of this country, robbing innocent people, taking their cash, taking their belongings under these so-called asset forfeiture laws. They don't even charge them with a crime. They're trying to feather the nest of their police departments and circumvent the taxing processes of this country. My gosh, my friends, even the German officials in the 1930s went through the pretense of charging innocent people with crimes before they robbed them of their valuables. Now, officials just say, sue us if you don't like it. And anyway, we make a new record drug bust every month or so. And that's supposed to be evidence of progress after 80 years? There's the beloved war on bigotry. That's been a big winner. Well, look, let's be positive, okay? I mean, let's look at the bright side of the war on bigotry. No negative campaigning. They've really wiped out all bigotry in our nation's capital, this model city in our great society. It's true. Well, okay. Unless you're attending a 4th of July barbecue this afternoon at the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. And isn't it great? Isn't it great to see Dole and Clinton up there anguishing and despairing on how they're going to fix their beloved welfare state and their beloved wars? You know, we're going to have tax reform, we promise, welfare reform, educational reform, regulatory reform. It's the same old reform claptrap we get from these parties every single election. Great about being a libertarian, and do we despair over the moral and the economic bankruptcy of this beloved wars and this welfare state? Oh God, not on your life. On the contrary, this is a time of great joy, of great celebration for us libertarians. We'd be depressed if the whole damn thing had worked. A bad tree will always bear rotten fruit, and you can tell a tree by the fruit it bears, and this is the fruit of the welfare state of the Democratic and Republican tree. And my friends, my libertarian friends, they cannot say that we didn't tell them that this would happen, because we did tell them so, and they know we told them. 50 years ago, Friedrich Hayek wrote his monumental book, The Road to Serfdom. It was recently republished in a 50th anniversary edition. Hayek, of course, was a libertarian. In fact, one of his most famous essays is Why I Am Not a Conservative. He would go on to win the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Science. And he dedicated The Road to Serfdom to the socialists in all political parties, including the socialists in the Republican Party and the socialists in the Democratic Party. And Hayek said to them, if you continue traveling this road that you have now embarked upon, the road to the socialistic welfare state, the road to serfdom, you're going to end up with the same mindset, the same policies as the totalitarians that you profess to oppose. And what did the Democrats and Republicans say in response? They said to the American people, you don't need to listen to Hayek. Don't listen to the libertarians. And you know, my friends, what's sad about all this? I mean, yes, it's sad that they were telling people not to listen to us as their policies were causing more and more destruction among the American people. And it's sad that today these Democrats and Republicans, after causing this destruction, will not take responsibility for what they've wrought on the people of this country. But what's really pathetic about it all is how they look for scapegoats on which to blame the problems that they caused. And of course, their most popular scapegoat for both parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, is the immigrant, the person who is unable to defend himself. Oh, if we could only keep illegal aliens out of our society, our public schools, our public welfare, our public parks, our public hospitals, our public roads, why, we could save the beloved welfare state. Oh, build the walls around America. Save us. Have you ever noticed how it's only the public sector that complains about too many customers? Bad attitude about gas. Where are the Republicans? Oh, they preach moral values. They write the book of virtues. They quote the Bible. For example, Republicans will say to you, Jesus our Lord said, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. And when you ask a Republican, how do you reconcile that with what you are doing to these poor Cuban people and forcing them back into communist tyranny? You know what the Republican's response always is? We can't take the Bible too literally. My friends, this is one of the reasons why it's so great to be a libertarian. Unlike these two other parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, we take great pride in the Statue of Liberty. Send us your tired, your huddled, your poor masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shores, and we libertarians will embrace them. We will never abandon them. We will never forsake them. We will never turn our backs on them. I'm really sorry. I just realized that I had not talked about the most monumental event in the history of our country. The Republican Revolution. What a farce that turned out to be. You know, if Dole were smart, I mean, look, he's losing, what, 17% in the polls? If he were smart, he'd approach Clinton and cut a deal. No, look. Here's the deal. Clinton agrees to drop Gore from the ticket and replace him with Dole. They're flip sides of the same coin. They're two peas in a pod. They're two wings of the same party. And to prove it, these two ideological bedmates, Clinton and Dole, get together, along with their buddy Alan Greenspan, head of the Federal Reserve System, the agency. They deserve to be booed and hooted too. The agency that has debased our currency for umpteen decades and plundered and looted the American people. And then they did it again. The three of them got together and plundered $50 billion from the American people and sent it down in the form of a gigantic welfare payment, this loot, to some political hacks in the Republic of Mexico. Where was the congressional vote? Where were the stalwart defenders of the Constitution among the Republican revolutionaries? You know, the separation of powers? You know, the constitutional authority of Congress to levy taxes on the American people, to decide the expenditure of tax revenues? Oh, they had run for cover. And these three people, on their own, did this. And then Clinton and Dole have the audacity, the gall, to stand before the American people after doing this to them and saying, well, if you vote for the libertarians, you're just going to be wasting your vote. If you want your vote to count, you're going to have to vote for one of us. How much more could you insult the self-esteem of the American people than that after doing that to them? I mean, it's, my friend, it's like two rapists standing over their victim and smiling and saying, well, we know you didn't like what we did to you, but you really don't have a choice. You're going to have to hug one of us. And what better way to waste your vote than to vote for one of those two characters? It's only going to encourage them. If you want to see the end, not the reform, of the socialistic welfare state way of life, hearken to us. If you want to see the end, not the reform, of the Internal Revenue Service and the 16th Amendment, hearken to us. If you want to see the end, not the reform of the Departments of Education, Agriculture, HUD, Health and Human Services, and every single other department that takes money from those to whom it belongs in order to feather the nest of those to whom it does not belong, hearken to us. If you want to see the end, not the reform of the Departments of Labor, Energy, Commerce, OSHA, the DEA, and every single other agency that has sent its swarms of regulators across our land like a swarm of locusts eating out our substance, harassing us, hearken to us. If you want to see the end, not the reform, of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Yes, if you never again want to see these murderous, Gestapo, bigoted thugs entrapping innocent people, if you never again want to see deadly gas being used against innocent women and children, if you never again want to see an innocent woman having her head exploded apart by a federal sniper using a bullet paid for with your tax money, if you never again want to see federal officials being awarded medals of valor after shooting a 14-year-old boy in the back. If you never again want to see FBI cover-ups, perjury, obstruction of justice, and the keeping of files on the American people in case you get out of line. If you're sick and tired of the direction which this nation has taken under these Democrats and Republicans. If you believe in the principles of morality and liberty on which this nation was founded. If you believe that the Constitution is one of the most important documents in history. Yeah! Yeah! If you believe in free minds and free markets, hearken to us. Join us, the Libertarian Party, the third largest political party in America, in perhaps the most exciting, grandest endeavor in history. the restoration of American liberty. This has indeed been a century of darkness. But when the history of the 20th century is ultimately written, the historians will undoubtedly record that there was one small beacon of light, a light of hope, and that that hope shone through you. They will undoubtedly write that it was the libertarians and the Libertarian Party of the United States who led not just America, who led mankind through the darkness, out of the socialistic morass, off of the road to serfdom, and up onward to the highest reaches of freedom ever seen by man.
I can show you the world.
President of the Future of Freedom Foundation, a free market libertarian think tank based in Virginia. He was speaking at the Libertarian Party's national convention that's taking place this weekend here in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, author Roger Morris. That's in 60 seconds. You're tuned to Democracy Now!, the daily political talk show for the 1996 election year. I'm Amy Goodman. Everyone expected it to happen this presidential election year after the Willie Horton ads back in 1988 and the mudslinging around Jennifer Flowers in 1992 and around Hillary Clinton now. It was inevitable that personal attacks on Bill Clinton and the First Lady would flow fast and furious in this year's campaign for the White House. Recently, these attacks have reached an unprecedented volume, first with the anonymous work of fiction Primary Colors, then from the massively promoted, supposedly insider version of the campaign by the Washington Post's Bob Woodward, and now to the admittedly second and third-hand version of behind-the-scenes events in the White House by former FBI agent Gary Aldrich. But there's yet another new book in the growing gallery of salacious campaign literature, but it seems a little different from the rest. Partners in Power, The Clintons and Their America, is by Roger Morris, the former National Security Council official who resigned in the early 1970s as a protest against the bombing of Cambodia during the Vietnam War, and who's made a career ever since of exposing the misdeeds of such prominent politicians as Henry Kissinger, Alexander Haig, and Richard Nixon. Because Morris has mostly been involved in researching the lives and works of conservative Republicans, his very negative portrayal of Bill and Hillary Clinton may gain credibility while other sensational studies of the Clintons are dismissed. Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky speaks with Roger Morris about his new book.
Roger Morris, when we last spoke nationwide on Pacifica, it was about 2 years ago on the occasion of Richard Nixon's funeral. And at that time, you had written, several years before, Richard Milhouse Nixon, The Rise of an American Politician, Volume 1 of Nixon's Life. You'd taken him only up through 1953, and when we spoke at that time, you said you were hard at work on trying to bring him further up to date in the 40 or so years that he still lived. What detoured you from your extensive, exhaustive, and definitive study of Richard Nixon to the Clintons?
My publisher, Henry Holt, suggested a book on the Clintons not long after the inauguration, and I was, I think, at that point eager to take it on. I thought this president embodied unique hope in American politics. I had been at his inaugural and in by accident on the roads in Virginia leading into the Capitol as he and his entourage entered to Washington for those pre-inaugural ceremonies. I was intrigued, frankly, by the Clintons as a couple and by the political potential of the administration. I went to Arkansas first in the spring and summer of 1993, 3 years ago, for what I thought would be a brief background look at the president. And of course, like so many who've gone to Arkansas, I found myself in the midst of a very, very different story. It became at once a very different book. I discovered that the story of this presidency was not its present, but its past. And that one had to look at Arkansas and at the rise to power, not only of Bill Clinton, but of Hillary Rodham Clinton as well, in order to understand what was happening and what would happen in Washington.
Was there a single event or a single occasion or a single occurrence or a single discovery that set off the light bulb in Roger Morris's head and said, aha, this is something, a story about the Clintons that really has to be told?
Yes, it was absolutely a single event, a single visit, really, to Hot Springs, to the president's real hometown. You know, he billed himself as the man from Hope, this little town in southwestern Arkansas where he was born, but he left there at the age of 5 and spent most of his formative years in Hot Springs, Arkansas. And I discovered very early on that Hot Springs was not just any hometown of any president. It was, of course, one of the most wide-open cities in America. It was a mob-ruled, virtual mob capital for years and years, especially the years in which Bill Clinton was growing up in the 1950s and 60s. The great families of organized crime gathered there for summit meetings, and they ran Hot Springs, ran its vice and its bookie and prostitution operations, its slot machines. At one time in the late 1950s and early 60s, Hot Springs, in its illegal gambling, generated more income, more revenue than Las Vegas, Nevada. So it was a remarkable place of political corruption and of what could only be called an organized crime capital.
And what effect do you think that had on the young Bill Clinton growing up in an atmosphere like that?
Well, I think there were manifold effects. First of all, his family was very intimately involved in all of that atmosphere. His mother and stepfather were frequent guests at these various nightclubs where they gambled. His mother was really a compulsive gambler at the Oaklawn racetrack. They knew a lot of these figures in organized crime. Roger Clinton, his stepfather, had grown up in Hot Springs, and Virginia, his mother, had been going there since she was quite a young woman growing up in Hope. Moreover, the brother of the stepfather, a man named Raymond Clinton, a prominent Buick dealer in Hot Springs, ran slot machines and bookie operations and other vice out of the back rooms of his various businesses. He was uniquely linked to some of the organized crime elements, as well as being a member of the Ku Klux Klan and a very prominent Democrat in Hot Springs. So the influences were many and quite direct. Later on, when Bill Clinton launches his political career, it's with money and support from Uncle Raymond and from other friends of the family who had run these backroom vice operations.
Many people grow up in disadvantaged backgrounds and overcome those backgrounds, take advantage of what they've got to build what they want to build. What's wrong with Bill Clinton having done the same thing?
Well, absolutely nothing is wrong. I think there is a wonderful success story here of a young man who grew up as an abused child. He was rather savagely abused by his alcoholic stepfather. The book tells the story of how he was often taken by his mother to a pediatrician or to local emergency rooms, where Virginia Clinton then effectively expunged the records, tried to get them destroyed or put aside for fear of family embarrassment. At the time, of course, in the 50s and 60s, violence in the home and child abuse was a socially embarrassing phenomenon. Nothing wrong with Bill Clinton having overcome that and gone on to great success, except, of course, that he bears very much the scars of that experience as well. He learned very early on, as psychologists know about the children of alcoholics, the abused ones especially, to present two faces in the world. One, a public face, often lying and evading and manipulating, and of course, inside inside a deeper and darker private reality, which led to a real feeling, I think, of division in his own personality and ultimately a contempt toward the public that he was serving in Arkansas. This is a tortured child, an abused child in the presidency who bears, I think, many of the marks of that abuse.
Much of what you write about in your book, Partners in Power, Roger Morris, has been written about elsewhere in David Marinus and other studies of Bill Clinton, including the part that you're just talking about. When you start to go off into new territory, I think, and catch the reader up very suddenly, at least this reader, it's around page 100, when you start talking about Bill Clinton at Oxford and what you call his ties to the intelligence community. You basically say in here, using anonymous sources, apparently half a dozen of them, in the intelligence community, that Bill Clinton, around the time of the famous letter to his draft board and all the manipulation with ROTC and the high lottery number, the story that's well known from 1992, you basically say that Bill Clinton was recruited by the CIA as a person to snitch on the anti-war movement. Are you uncomfortable printing this based on sources you can't name?
No, not at all, because, as you know, this is a book with 30 very tightly packed, single-spaced pages of footnotes that back it up. There are relatively few confidential sources in this book. Those that are used are, for the most part, quotations that amplify or expand upon statements of fact that are already backed up by documentary evidence. This was one of the very few places where there was an assertion of fact based upon confidential sources, and the way that passage is written, it indicates that there's conflicting evidence. It's not a foregone conclusion. But I was persuaded that the people I talked to, who had been former CIA operatives both in the United States and abroad, were utterly serious people who had no axes to grind politically. They had no political agenda in telling me these stories. They were describing an episode in history which they regarded as quite ironic. You remember that in 1992, George Bush and the Republicans tried to accuse Bill Clinton of being disloyal, of having... was the implication that he might have even worked for the KGB or for the other side. These sources told me in utter seriousness that it was quite the opposite. They were familiar with something called Operation Chaos, which was an effort by Lyndon Johnson ordering the CIA to find out if there was any North Vietnamese or Soviet influence in the anti-war movement, which was then very controversial in the United States. The CIA did go out and recruit informers among American students, both abroad and in the United States, to inform on their fellow anti-war activists. Bill Clinton was one of those. I'm convinced that these sources were quite accurate and right. They were, because of the nature of their work in the intelligence community, confidential. They had to remain anonymous if they were going to tell me these stories at all. So I'm not uncomfortable with that. There were many of them. They kept, in some cases, contemporaneous documentation, that is, diaries and other notations that I thought were quite persuasive.
The question, however, leaps to mind, if Bill Clinton did have this intelligence connection, and we don't, of course, know how profound it was, he could have been protected against the very type of thing that he was trying to avoid, that is to say, military service. The CIA would have been involved in some sort of quid pro quo, wouldn't it? If he did have this connection as some sort of informant or snitch, why did he still have to go through all those contortions with his draft board and ROTC?
Well, it's true, first of all, that the agency did offer various inducements to these students to become informers, one of which was help with their local draft boards if they needed it. And indeed, there were cases. I talked to former CIA officers themselves who had been helped with the draft, had been given exemptions by the agency. That was true in several cases. I think what happens here is that Bill Clinton is already in a process of evading the draft. He's already well down the road in Arkansas in trying to deal with this before he's actually recruited or contacted by the CIA. He's in the ROTC when he goes back to Oxford. He's got that arrangement with Colonel Holmes, and he's waiting for the lottery. The CIA involvement comes, I think, at a time when he's already fixed for the draft. If you look at the sequence of events there, if he had not drawn a high lottery number, he could have resorted to the ROTC, perhaps to some help by the CIA. If he had had a low number, he still would have needed help in getting out of the draft, obviously.
Before we turn to Hillary Clinton, one last question about this intriguing episode. the CIA and other intelligence agencies operate on one, as we've learned over the years, in many ways, one of which ways is basically blackmail. If he had done something like this, been a snitch on people in the anti-war movement to whatever degree, the intelligence establishment would have had and perhaps still has some hold over him, wouldn't they?
My book suggests that. My book talks in some detail in one of its chapters on the crimes of MENA, the great gun and drug smuggling operation in western Arkansas in the early 80s, that Bill Clinton was indeed susceptible, quite vulnerable to compromise by the intelligence community for his early involvement and for much else as well. I think that's just a rather obvious and dark fact about modern American politics. We know that the CIA kept dossiers on various politicians. We know that there are very substantial and serious allegations of CIA involvement in the election campaigns against some of their critics, people like Otis Pike and Frank Church and so on. This is not at all uncommon. They would, of course, have kept those files on Bill Clinton. In fact, one of my sources told me that he had seen specific notations in the agency records on Operation Chaos in the mid-1970s and late 1970s that Bill Clinton was already emerging as an electoral politician in Arkansas and was running for attorney general and so on. That was the kind of institutional memory that the agency would have kept for future use.
The devastating information and approach that you have to Bill Clinton can certainly be gauged in this little bit that we've talked about here. But let's look for a moment at Hillary Clinton, who, if anything, comes out worse in your book, to my mind, than Bill Clinton does. Someone who started off life as something of an idealist, traveled quite far from her parents' Midwestern, solid suburban Republican roots, participated to some extent in the civil rights and anti-war movement, even attended the Chicago Convention in 1968 and was horrified at the police brutality that she saw there, and then became a very, very different type of person. What do you think turned Hillary Clinton from a relatively young, idealistic person, concerned about the poor, concerned about issues of inequality, to the woman that you later portray as someone interested only in personal self-advancement and wealth?
You know, I'm not sure, Larry, that it's as much a transition, as much a passage, as you've just depicted it. I think that Hillary Clinton had perhaps less distance to go than might appear. She does indeed grow up in this affluent suburb of Chicago, Park Ridge. Her father drives a Cadillac. He's a successful owner of a small drapery business. He gets a remarkable contract from the airlines, for example, in Chicago, to fit those little draperies on the windows of the old prop-driven planes in the 50s and 60s. But inside that home, there is a tortured family as well. Her father, as the book describes, was emotionally abusive. Nothing was ever good enough for Hugh Rodham. He treated his children very much like the Navy boot camp recruits he had instructed and somewhat tyrannized as a boot camp instructor in World War II. She emerges from that home in Park Ridge and goes off to Wellesley, I think somewhat a broken young woman with a very hard and defensive veneer acquired. She does experiment with what we would call more socially progressive views. She's never really an opponent of the war. She supports Hubert Humphrey in 1968. She was not a delegate to that convention in 68 in Chicago, only an onlooker, only a suburban girl with a friend who comes in and witnesses the brutality against the students who were demonstrating. She's a very careful and cautious rebel at Wellesley, very much still a part of the establishment. There is a brief interval when she comes out of law school and goes to work in Washington for then-Senator Walter Mondale's Migrant Labor Subcommittee, when she becomes something of a radical. She pickets the president of Coca-Cola when he comes to testify about migrant labor camps, and she makes a rather progressive, incendiary speech to the League of Women Voters. But very soon after marrying Bill Clinton and embarking upon, I think, a very conscious decision to make sacrifices in order to rise politically, to really pursue her ambition of power, she reverts back to the corporate lawyer that I think Hillary Rodham was always going to be. I don't see any contradiction, that much contradiction, between the Hillary Rodham who exploits the commodity trades and deals with some of the most venal and backward interests in Arkansas, and the Hillary Rodham Adam, who grew up in Park Ridge.
You write of her later on that she would be outwardly impressive in all of her work in the Children's Defense Fund or in a desegregation scheme for Little Rock Federal Courts or one of those activities there, yet on closer examination, substantively vacant in the end. What do you mean by substantively vacant?
Well, there's always less to Hillary Rodham Clinton than meets the eye. She's advertised as being highly intelligent and very serious, and in the Arkansas record, we were told, often successful in what she did. If one looks very close, there is indeed an absence of substance. Her work for the American Bar Association in that review was very ritual, very routine in its content. The desegregation case in Arkansas still hasn't been completely solved. That was a political device that she really adopted for purposes of her own and her husband's advance. What she does with children's issues, with child care in Arkansas, is nothing less than a scandal. Her husband's administration was eventually sued for gross negligence by some of the same organizations she had been associated with. Even her role in the Children's Defense Fund and other foundations during the 1980s is described by those who served with her on those boards as being very lackluster, very moderate. She was always concerned about her image and her sheer presence in these activities, but what she actually does behind the scenes adds up to very little. So that's what I meant by a vacancy of substance.
We're talking with Roger Morris, author of Partners in Power, published recently by Henry Holt, The Clintons and Their America, a devastating critique of Bill and Hillary Rodham Clinton. We'll be right back with more discussion of this, including the infamous activities in Mena, Arkansas, the drug and gun running, and the implications of Roger Morris's study for the 1996 election. This is Democracy Now! On Pacifica Radio. I'm Larry Bensky. Roger Morris, author of Partners in Power, The Clintons and Their America. Talk for a minute, if you would, about the incidents that went on in Arkansas under Governor Clinton at the Mena airstrip.
Well, this was an enormous crime, Larry. It took place from the early to mid-1980s. It involved, of course, the Iran-Contra scandal. The CIA, in contravention of congressional restrictions, was flying arms illegally down to the Contras in Central America. This was an operation begun and condoned, of course, by the Reagan White House. On the way back, the smugglers were allowed, I think even encouraged, to bring back whatever they desired. And the chief smuggler operating out of Mena, Arkansas, was a man named Barry Seal, who flew back into the United States literally billions of dollars worth of cocaine. You're quite right that this has received some attention in the nation and elsewhere, in fact, on the left and the right, but has remained very much a marginal story, never tackled by the mainstream media. We now have, and I think that's what the book presents, absolutely definitive, incontrovertible evidence, law enforcement files, and in addition, I draw on the 2,500-page archive of the chief smuggler, Barry Seal himself, which was obtained by my colleague, investigative reporter Sally Denton, who got the personal papers of the man who was running this operation. They leave no doubt that this was a massive, massive smuggling conspiracy, which involved not only the CIA, but also organized crime in the United States, who were distributing the cocaine in cities and towns all over America. The then governor of Arkansas, Bill Clinton, at least, at the very least, East looked the other way. He condoned this trafficking. We know that one of his state police bodyguards, a man named L.D. Brown, who had been something of his protege, confronted him with the evidence of Mina in 1984, 85, and Clinton simply waved him off and said, wait, whoa, that's Lassiter's deal, referring to one of his principal backers and most intimate friends in Little Rock, the bond broker and later convicted drug dealer Dan Lassiter. And we know also that there was a 3,000-page Arkansas State Police archive with which Clinton was familiar, detailing what was going on at MENA. There were attempts in the later 1980s on the part of local law enforcement, IRS agents and Arkansas State Police investigators and others, even local prosecutors, to do something about this enormous crime, to bring those who were responsible to justice. Each time, over 9 different investigations were suppressed by the powers that be, stopped by either the White House or by the Justice Department or by local political authorities. It's a very sad and seedy story. It's a story of bipartisan collusion, of the juncture between government and organized crime.
And yet, you would think that somebody wants to bring this out at this point, somebody who wants to emphasize the corruption and personality problems that Bill Clinton and Hillary Rodham Clinton have, as you outline in your book, but it doesn't come out. It comes out on the web. I mean, I read all kinds of right-wing websites that have been screaming about Dan Lassiter and MENA, Arkansas for years, but it doesn't come out in the establishment press. And congressional committees, except as I believe you mentioned, Congressman Jim Leach has sort of skirted along the edges of it in his House Banking Committee, it doesn't come out. Why not?
You know, there are a variety of reasons for that. First of all, this is a huge story, which the media very largely missed. It required serious investigative reporting, which doesn't go on in America anymore to any degree at all. It does involve both the Republicans and the Democrats. I don't think there's a stake anywhere in the Congress or in the White House in this story being fully explored. I think no one here is without responsibility or guilt. I think as well that it's, as the book, I hope, details in some precision, there is a fundamental corruption in the media itself, a corruption in its own sociology of knowledge, a corruption in its own hostage status to corporate power, a basic corruption of its substance. This was a story that no one really wanted to know and no one really got. I do think that Congressman Leach will do more than skirt the edges. I think the report of his banking committee coming out in September will have a great deal to say about MENA and about money laundering and all the rest. But Larry, this is the vast dark side of American politics. This really is the juncture of government and crime, which neither the right nor the left has really been able to expose before, and which the great mushy political center has no stake in bringing to the surface.
One of the corruptions of media that you write about in your book, Roger Morris, is one that you call a tabloid intimacy with personal scandal, passing for investigative reporting, even political understanding. Are you uncomfortable at all with contributing a bit to this tabloid intimacy with personal scandal in your portrayal in Partners in Power of Bill Clinton as basically a sexual predator, a satyr, and as Hillary Rodham Clinton as having had an affair with Vincent Foster, all of the purported drug use on the part of Bill Clinton that you write about in this book? Are you uncomfortable with participating in that trend in journalism which you decry?
Not at all, because I don't really participate in that trend. I approach those issues and I deal with them in the book not as matters of personal morality, not as simply matters of private scandal, but rather as they affect the political process. Let's take the womanizing, for example. Bill Clinton, of course, didn't just do this as a private citizen. He often swept into these county fairs and state conventions as the governor, his state police bodyguards acting as procurers of young women and then standing guard during his trysts. He used the instruments of government to cover up this history. He was at every turn abusing his power, exploiting the political process, hiding behind his status as governor. The same is true of the drug use. He was allegedly the leading law enforcement officer of the state. He was leading the war on drugs at the same time he was using cocaine himself, and most of all, condoning and watching it used in massive amounts amounts by his brother and by some of his intimate backers and friends like Dan Lassiter. There's an enormous hypocrisy in all of this, which goes to the question of political character. I wouldn't have cared at all about Bill Clinton's private life, his sex life, his drug use, or his wife's private life if it hadn't impinged so greatly on the political process. And Hillary Rodham Clinton's affair with Vince Foster was not just any First Lady's love affair. This is someone who then later is appointed Deputy White House Counsel, who handles the most sensitive matters of national security and personal finance of the first couple, and who ends up dead under mysterious circumstances 6 months after the inauguration. So these, I think, are legitimate areas of political inquiry to ask how much they exposed a future president and first lady to blackmail, what's really going on here, how much the political process itself was corrupted. That's not private scandal anymore. That has long ago, I think, verged over into the public domain.
As you know, the campaign strategy of Bob Dole and the Republicans centers in part, perhaps even in large part, on trying to make the character issue of Bill and Hillary Rodham Clinton central issues in 1996. Are you uncomfortable with your book, Partners in Power, being used already by people like Rush Limbaugh to help that Republican campaign strategy?
As you well know, as a journalist or a writer, you know, your first obligation here is to get the information out. There really is, if one starts making judgments about what political factions will do with it or how they'll exploit it, I think you're lost. In a democracy and certainly under the intent of the First Amendment, I think our job is to present the facts as best we can, as well documented as we can make them, and let the public make those decisions. So I'm not concerned about how the political process here will use the book. If anyone reads the book seriously, they will see that it's a critique not only of the Clintons, but of the political system at large. I say specifically that we're at the end of century dead end in this bipartisan disaster that we have wrought. It's every bit as critical of the Republicans and of the Washington culture of complicity as it is of the Clintons and their culture in Little Rock. It seems to me that this is that the Clintons and the whole story here is really symptomatic of what has happened to our larger political system, to the death of democracy, and I would hope that it would be read in that spirit.
The part of me that reads this book as an ordinary citizen, a part I try always to preserve somehow beyond my role as a journalist and a writer, whatever, said to me as I finished it, I can't vote for these people. This is an appalling, unprincipled, self-centered, possibly criminal, certainly corrupt couple. And then I look on the other side in the major parties and I see Bob Dole and I think to myself the same kind of thoughts I had back in 1968, Humphrey or Nixon. How can this country have advanced so little in so much time?
Well, this book is really an effort to try to make this country face up to the depth of its dysfunction in the political system. You know, Bill Clinton came to power in 1992, I think, on a grand illusion, and the illusion was that he was something different, that he was not a product of the system. We knew very little about his history. That Arkansas past was largely ignored or covered up. Of course, they covered it up. It went to great pains to do so in the campaign. I just think we have to face up to that dysfunction. The book says quite explicitly that Bob Dole is the worn epitome of the old system in Washington. Just recently, we saw the spectacle of both these candidates going to Las Vegas to get massive amounts of money, more than $5 million from gambling interests. That's every bit as corrupt as it always was. There's no redemption here on either side of the aisle. I think we've got to start over. I would hope that this book would be an incentive for people all the more to recognize the necessity of a third or a fourth or a fifth party. Someone said to me this morning, we need at least a second party in America. We're at the dead end of this system, and the Clintons are not exceptions. They're not somehow aberrations in this process. They're simply emblematic of where we've come.
You finished writing this book, I believe, early this year in about March, as you signed the preface, March 1996. Inevitably, there were loose ends that are still coming out, events that may happen over the next few months, which might cause the Clintons even more trouble than they are in, as you write about in your book, Partners in Power, Roger Morris. What should the public be looking at in the next few months as possible developments in all of the scandals and scandalettes that are swirling around the Clintons?
Well, I think there's no question that the FBI file scandal, and now just yesterday in a copyrighted story by the Washington Times, the revelation that there is a huge database, computer database in the White House, quite secret, containing information, financial and otherwise, on tens of thousands of Americans, an enormous invasion of privacy, dwarfs anything that we knew about the Nixon administration. I think those revelations ought to be looked at very carefully. As an abuse of presidential power, really as a constitutional abuse. I don't know that Bill Clinton is going to resign or be challenged directly before he is renominated and before the November election. But I think we face here a very long crisis. If he should be reelected in November, it seems to me a replay of 1972-73 when Richard Nixon defeated George McGovern, only to face literally days after his inauguration for a second term. The beginning of the undoing of the administration in the Watergate crisis. I think we're going to see more prosecutions from the independent counsel, Kenneth Starr in Little Rock, who's building a very methodical case, brick by brick. You'll see more White House aides perhaps going to jail, certainly being indicted. And I would expect that this will come right to the second floor of the White House, to the door of the First Lady and the President himself. So we're in for a very rough ride. I see no quick end to this scandal. And I see it on the other end, as you mentioned earlier, more revelations about Senator Robert Dole and his obeisance, really, his service to the great vested interest, the tobacco industry and to agribusiness and all the rest. I would hope this just says to the American people, you can't go on with this system. You can't go on settling for the lesser of evils.
Finally, Roger Morris, you're in a unique position as a historian who has studied the life of Richard Nixon so much over the years and now the Clintons over the past few years to put the American political system in some sort of context. As I was reading this book, I went back and read through some of your first volume of the Nixon work, which, by the way, I hope you'll get back to doing now that you're done with this book. And I was struck by similarities in the early corruption of political figures who might have had a much better outcome. What does this say about American society in your researches?
Well, I think this system has been implicitly corrupt now for most of this century. We know what the seedy history of the last half of the 19th century was. I think we're under the illusion that the progressive period and period of reform in the first 20 or 30 years of this century had left something more benign in its wake. That's not true. I think American politics are more corrupt, more pervasively corrupt than ever. I think it says something about the corruption of the society as well. These are people who do not very largely resist their early corruption. Bill Clinton and Richard Nixon are tragic figures, ambitious, talented young men who are presented with that corruption very early in their careers and who succumb to it. They don't wage a great Shakespearean or Grecian fight against evil, either in their character or their political career. I think that says something about the corruption of the society itself. You know, Bill Clinton talks about that in his famous letter to Colonel Holmes, where he says at one point, it may be that our society is corrupt, but if that's true, then we're all lost. And I think, in a sense, we are lost in this present political system. I would hope that this book is a call to an awakening, a real recognition of how profound that corruption has become and the absolute necessity of starting over.
Roger Morris, author of Partners in Power, The Clintons and Their America, published by Henry Holt. Thank you very much for joining us on Pacifica Radio.
And thanks for that interview, Larry. Well, that about wraps up the show. By the way, folks, on Monday on C-SPAN, I'll be on Washington Journal at 8 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. It's an hour show where we discuss the news of the day, and it would be wonderful to hear some of your voices. It is call-in. Nice to hear some Pacifica on C-SPAN, so I hope you're able to tune in. And Monday on Democracy Now!, another look at third-party politics, we'll speak with organizer Ronnie Duggar of The Alliance, a progressive populist movement. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with assistance from Erica Martinez at the studios of Pacifica Station WPFW here in Washington, D.C. Kenneth Mason is our engineer, and if you'd like a copy of today's show, you can buy a tape cassette. by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You can also call us on our listener comment line. We might play some of those comments on the air. You can reach us at 202-588-0988, extension 313. Once again, 202-588-0988, extension 313. Or you can send us some email. Our address is democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!